Council come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams. Leonard.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Sten.
Here.
Potter.
Here. We have one item to take care of before we hear the 2 p.m. time certain. It's item 191. Commissioner Leonard.
Thank you, Mayor Potter. Mayor and I have worked hard together on this in the past week, and the result is a consensus resolution that I think is actually going to be very helpful in addressing some of the concerns we heard last week and the week before, but still get at the issue all of us said that we supported, and that is to allow firefighters and police officers talk at the bargaining table about their safety. So I am very happy with this, and I appreciate very much Mayor Potter's work on this. And I move to substitute this language.
Second.
Discussion? Please call the vote.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
I appreciate the Chief's hard work on this, and glad to vote aye.
Potter?
And likewise, I do too. I thought it was it meets the needs, I think, of both our public safety officials as well as the city. So I heartily support this and encourage the legislature to take note. Aye.
So do we need to vote one more time
on the actual resolution? That was for the sub. Leonard.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Sten.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye. Please read the 2 p.m. time certain.
Agenda item 198, accept staff report and recommendation and order of council for Gary Dye, Measure 37 claim.
Interesting. As staff's coming forward, I want to just acknowledge St. Francis Academy in the balcony. Hi, guys.
Understand you have a relative up there?
I have Nicole Sidebotham. Hi, Nicole. My favorite 14-year-old in the world.
I like them. They came by my office and visited.
Yes, I heard.
Very good.
Excellent.
Okay, we're going to start. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which entity he or she is authorized to represent. We'll start with Chris Durth, Bureau of Planning. Please proceed, Chris.
Thank you. I'm Chris Durth, the City's Measure 37 Program Manager, and I'm here to present a claim brought by Gary Dye. On his property in southeast Portland. It's located in the Pleasant Valley neighborhood. This aerial photograph shows you the property in the center there, outlined in red. You can see this was taken 2 years ago before construction on the property. The area was heavily forested. You can see it's zoned R10C, that's an environmental conservation zone. And it's bordered on the south by the Willamette National Cemetery, which is zoned open space. To summarize the claim for you, it's brought by Gary Dye at Southeast Lexington and 120th Avenue. Submitted in December of last year. Compensation demanded is $168,000. The preferred resolution is compensation or waiver of the challenge regulations. And as you recall, our analysis of Measure 37 claims include these six criteria. I won't go through them. You've seen them many times before. First, the ownership. Gary Dye first purchased the subject property in September of 1994. He then sold it to his father just 2 years later in 1996 and purchased it back 3 years later in 1999. So for purposes of this claim, the family ownership dates back to September 1994, and Gary Dye's current ownership dates to September of 1999. The regulations challenged by Mr. Dye are these, in his words, the environmental zone restrictions, enforced stewardship of the undisturbed area, the city's prohibition of a fence, the city's prohibition of security lighting, the city's environmental review fee, the city's additional delays in processing site fees and building permits, the city's requirement for extra stormwater management, the city's restriction of landscaping to native plants exclusively, and as he alleges, the pain, suffering, and anxiety that he states he has endured. So next we look to see whether these regulations are land use regulations as defined by Measure 37, and we find that only the environmental zone regulations are land use regulations under the measure. But those include the four items you see here, the stewardship of the undisturbed area, the prohibition of offense, the security lighting, and the landscaping of native plants. Those are all part of the environmental zone regulations and are land use regulations under Measure 37. The other items that you see here, the environmental review fee, the alleged delays in processing site fees, and the city's requirement for stormwater management are not land use regulations under Measure 37, so aren't subject to challenge under the measure. And then finally, pain and suffering are not covered under Measure 37. Just to give you a little background, Gary Dye did file a previous Measure 37 claim prior to this one in December of 2004. BDS staff worked extensively with Mr. Dye over a period of months, including four site visits to work through development issues with him, resulting in the approval of an environmental review on September 9th, 2005, to construct a house. This is the environmental review that Mr. Dye received in September of 2005, and that is sufficient evidence of enforcement under Measure 37. It's worth noting that Mr. Dye did not appeal the decision, the environmental review decision at the time, to LUBA, as was his right. In fact, he was so happy with that environmental review that he wrote me this nice letter in September of 2005 saying, "I wish to withdraw my claim," this was the previous claim, "for Measure 37 compensation. The city and I have reached a good compromise and understanding for the use of my property through the environmental review process. I considered any disagreements I might have had with the city over the use of my land to be a thing of the past. I look forward to my stewardship of my property as set forth in the E-zone in which it sits." He further states in his letter that he was very pleased with the assistance he received from Eric Engstrom and others at BDS. Then later, he was issued a building permit in August of 06, and construction commenced. It's still, as far as I know, underway on his property. And he filed his second Measure 37 claim, that's the one before you today, in December of last year. Next, we look to see whether the regulations that are challenged are regulations that are exempt under Measure 37. And as you recall, under Section 3, the Act, it states that the Act shall not apply to land use regulations which are enacted prior to the date of acquisition of the property by the owner or a family member of the owner who owned the subject property prior to acquisition by the owner. So we look back in to the zoning maps in place prior to when Mr. Dye purchased his property. That's his property. It's hard to see it. It's in yellow or green there on the sort of the right side of the zoning map. This map, you can see, is dated from August of 1991. And you can see that the zoning in place in 1991 was R10C, conservation overlay, the same as it is today. Then Mr. Dye purchased the property 4 years later in 1994. This is a warranty deed showing that purchase date in September of 1994. This was his original purchase. So he first purchased it 3 years after the regulations were enforced on the property. And then when he repurchased it the second time in 1999, that was 8 years after the regulation was enforced on the property. So in conclusion, what we found was that what Mr. Dye would be required to do on his property was established by council action adopting the environmental overlay in 1991. The requirements have remained essentially the same from 91 through purchase in 1994, through repurchase in 1999, and remain in place today. So because the challenged E-zone regulations are exempt from Measure 37 challenge in this claim, we find that there's been no restriction of use or reduction in value in the property. So to summarize the entire claim discussion here, we find that the environmental zone overlay requirements are indeed land use regulations under Measure 37. The E-zone was enacted in 91 prior to Mr. Dye's first purchase of the property 3 years later. Therefore, the E-zone is exempt under Section 3E of the measure. And because the E-zone challenge is exempt, we find that there's been no restriction of use or loss of value of the property. So our recommendation to you today would be to deny Mr. Dye's Measure 37 claim. Be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Questions from the commissioners? Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
The claimant, please come forward. Thanks for being here today, folks.
Thank you.
When you speak, if you'd state your name for the record, we'd appreciate it, and you have a total of 15 minutes.
My name is Gary Dye, owner of the property.
And I'm Megan Dye, I suppose, co-owner of the property. And I'll start today. Mr. Mayor and commissioners, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to hear our concerns today. And we were truly hoping to avoid bringing this claim before you. Let me start by saying that Gary and I love Portland. He's a lifelong resident, born and raised here. About 15 years ago, I chose Portland as my home. We have a young son and are expecting another child later this year, and we look forward to raising our family in this city, and we hope our children grow to love Oregon and Portland as much as we do. Some of the values we hope to instill in our kids are caring for the environment, compassion towards others, basic fairness, and respect for the rights of others. We are here today asking that the city support these same values with regard to our property in Southeast Portland. When this property was originally purchased, it's true that the E-zone was in place, but the current restrictions were not. After filing an initial Measure 37 claim, Gary and I met with Eric Engstrom and Hannah Kuhn to see if a compromise could be reached within the existing environmental review process. After several meetings, we came to an agreement which required that we preserve 5,000 square feet of the property as undisturbed, as well as preserve a maple tree and Douglas fir tree that we originally wanted removed. Since reaching this land use agreement and beginning construction on the property, new circumstances have arisen which cause us great concern for not only our own safety, but that of our neighbors as well. The Doug fir sits precariously on a ledge and roots have been exposed over time prior to our construction. Our neighbors have expressed concern about this tree as their house sits in its direct path should it come down. Upon inspection, even the city forester could not ensure its viability. Our neighbors deserve to live in their home without the threat of a huge tree falling on their house, and we feel a responsibility to remove the tree as the only way to guarantee their safety, as well as the safety of anyone else who may either be passing by or have a car parked in this tree's path. Another safety concern we have is for the undisturbed 5,000 square feet at the back of the property. It has come to our attention that groups of kids have been making trails through the woods and have even constructed a primitive campsite, including a fire pit on the federal property that lies to the south. The fire department has been called on more than one occasion because of these fires, and the retaining wall in front of our property has already been tagged once in retaliation for involving the authorities. The only way to keep trespassers from disturbing our portion of this property is to build a fence. If we are to be effective at keeping these 5,000 square feet undisturbed, we need to be given the ability to keep the public off of our private property. We are one family, building one home. No, come here. We don't want to clear-cut our lot. We don't want to build a swimming pool or pave over everything to create a parking lot. In fact, we've done what many other property owners would never agree to do, essentially donate one-third of our private property to the city while having to pay taxes on it and maintain it at our own expense. We're asking to cut down a tree that has the potential to cause extremely serious damage and to fence the lot to protect our private property from public trespass. Thank you for your time.
You might want to ask, why did I write that letter thanking these people so much for the compromises and the agreement we made 2 years ago? And the reason is that we really didn't know exactly what the effects of that agreement were going to be, and things have really changed in the meantime. At that time, they were in the process of developing the Deerhaven development, basically across the street. We're not part of that development. We're a single lot. When we surveyed the property along with Kim Miller, there weren't very many people living there, and it was all wild and or wooded and thickets, and it's hard to even get back through there. In the meantime, with, I believe, now 36 houses built in the Deerhaven development, there's kids there, and now they are partying back there. They have built trails through my property and through the Willamette National Cemetery to access this area, actually damaging our undisturbed area as well as Willamette National Cemetery. They've set up a campsite. They're lighting fires. I have pictures of the fire pit. I've talked to Willamette National Cemetery officials, and they're seeing vandalism on their property and stealing things within the cemetery and bringing to this campsite. I think they're smoking pot. I hope that's maybe all they're doing. The fire department has been called out on numerous occasions to put out fires. My neighbors tell us of this, and the wild stuff's going on back there. So the fact that we agreed to have this undisturbed area without a fence, that would have worked back when we saw it 2 years ago. It doesn't work anymore. The solution from the Bureau of Development Services is to plant thorny thickets and things like that. But thorny thickets have already been hacked away to put in these virgin trails. I have a picture of a hole that they made through dense blackberries, which I couldn't get through 2 years ago. They've hacked through it, and now they have access to the Willamette National Cemetery. So to think that planting thorny brush and shrubs in the middle of this trail is going to stop them from entering and leaving and, you know, our property and even disturbing our privacy, I just don't think that's going to work. The other big issue, as my wife mentioned, is that the Bureau of Development Services insisted on three trees within the disturbed area that we were supposed to keep because they thought that these three trees were valuable. I guess they were kind of big. We did remove quite a few trees for building of the house and the driveway, and we have in our mitigation plan planting of a bunch of trees to mitigate from those that were cut down. But this one tree in front, we found out, is a problem. After those record rains in November and after the windstorms, the neighbors across the street, and I can show you a picture of their house, they were scared, and they called up the city to complain about this tree. And we got a letter from the Bureau of Development Services says their city art, you know, they wanted us to, they required a complete arborist report, including root excavation, must be submitted examining the safety of the tree. And I called up an arborist and say, well, how much does that cost? Well, we bring in a compressor, we blow the dirt off and do the roots, and it'll be about, we think, around $700 or so. And then on top of that, if the arborist says, yeah, it looks like that tree is unsafe, then I have to do another environmental review. And we were supposed to be grateful that they dropped the cost to $400 to accept that this tree needs to be cut down. And then I would file that in the county for $60. And the thing is, we had just done that in the agreement 2 years ago. We went through the environmental review process. We paid all those costs. Can't we just realize that this tree, including this tree, was a mistake, and I will even mitigate for it? It's in the front of the yard. It is completely isolated from any kind of ecosystem. What is the insistence to keep this tree? And the other problem is that in my building permit, I have to now put planter box. Now, the problem is that on the north side of this tree is a very big ledge. The tree is leaning toward that ledge. This is what makes the people across the street very nervous. Okay, so there's a problem on the north side. My building permit says I have to excavate and put a stormwater planter box on the east side, another stormwater planter box on the west side, and I need to have a driveway turnaround, which I need to excavate within 5 feet of that tree. So now all four sides of this tree, which people are already worried about, are going to be excavated. So when I ask the question in a letter to the BDS, do I need to hurry up, get this arborist report, file it with the city, so that if it's unsafe that I can cut it down now? But if the arborist says, well, it is safe, it is viable, I've got all this excavation to do the next few months. Do I have to go through the same process again in 4 months and have a second environmental review and a second root excavation and file a second thing in the county? They never did answer that question. Because no matter how you answer that question, it looks kind of stupid. Either we are forced to put on hold public safety for the next 4 months as I finish my construction and finally go to the arborist and see if the tree is now viable. You know, I either put the public at risk in the intervening time, or else I do two of these things within 4 months, whereas I did one, again, 2 years ago. That was never really addressed. That whole thing was kind of dismissed. And, you know, that happened about 1 week before my filing, and that and other things, you know, they were kind of bothering me, but I was living with it. But when I got that letter and I got that kind of response, I said, well, this is the last straw. And I filed another Measure 37 claim. It's, you know, it's really the only really power I have to have people sit up and wake up and listen. I'm very apologetic about it. I mean, it's really embarrassing and disappointing for me and my wife to be here, but you know, the experience we've had since we made that agreement a couple years ago, year and a half ago, just kept, you know, bothering us. There's a couple of other issues about the stormwater. I signed an agreement at the bequest of PDOT when they're designing the Deer Haven development below me. They wanted me to sign off on lowering Lexington so they could meet up better with 120th coming up the hill for connectivity reasons. Portland has a policy of connectivity. I signed off on that. The reason they wanted me to sign off on it is because when you lower the street, my lot is already up here above the street, and now it takes a lot more to get up to where I'm going to be building my house. My driveway is going to be much steeper and much longer to be below a certain grade. Okay, so I signed off on this. I didn't ask for anything in return from the developer or anybody else, but I thought in the environmental review it said that the properties along the south side of Lexington were going to be served by these public facilities, including the stormwater stuff. I bought into that. Okay. So when I build my house now, I find out that I'm going to be putting in $20,000 of excavation, digging out all that dirt in my house to try to move it forward, and another $20,000 of extra retaining walls to hold back the hill as I put in this long driveway. Okay, so now this driveway is so long that it's more than 1,000 square feet. And according to the city of Portland's criteria, now I have to collect my stormwater off my driveway in addition to my roofs. Okay? I have to bear that extra cost. Well, I thought I was going to be able to channel my stormwater to the curb and put it into the catch basin that the developer constructed for Deer Haven. And the Bureau of Development Services says, well, no, you can't use that, because that's for the Deer Haven development. So now I have to spend several thousand dollars, maybe even $4,000 to $5,000 on two planter boxes, whereas I've only counted in the 36 houses that are in Deer Haven, I've only counted two houses that have put in planter boxes, one apiece. I've got to put in two. And because this tree sits really in the only place for planter boxes, I have to put in two rather than one, for the most part, doubling the cost. And I just don't understand why the Bureau of Development Services has said you can't really use these facilities. The catch basin has a filter box. The houses on the end of Lexington are directly putting their stormwater to the curb using that stuff. And all I'm saying, I'd like to use it too and save me these costs. I don't have anything against planter boxes. I do have something against the cost. There's a couple of other small issues, and you know, a lot of the things in the Measure 37 claim, when I came to the table in the last couple of months talking with Chris, they weren't even a subject of conversation. You know, it's these small few issues that we really wanted to take care of, and we're very disappointed that there really didn't seem to be any budging of one inch on these things we are concerned about.
Questions for these folks? I just had one question for you, Mrs. Nye. You said that the current restrictions were not in place in 1991 when the environmental overlay zone went into effect.
It's our understanding that using the fence one is the one that I have on the top of my head, that went in place in 1995, and that Gary purchased the property in 1994, correct?
Right. I bought the property knowingly as a environmental zoned property. I really didn't understand, know too much what that meant. And the other thing was the 5,000 square foot restriction or of disturbed area. I believe that went, I think that went in 95, and I think the fence restriction went in 97. Another thing that really isn't environmental, but which really clashed with some of the other environmental restrictions was the snout house rule.
Okay, but that's...
Well, it really is a measure. Yeah, the snout house rule came in, I think, in the late 90s, and that really, because of the difficulty of getting on top of this lot from the street, I wanted to zoom right into the basically the basement of this house and have my stuff on top. But because of the snout house rule, I couldn't do it. And it really ended up, I had to build a bigger house than I really wanted to preserve the kind of the style I wanted, but to be able to, you know, have a garage.
And there's also, like, the stormwater management. We found that going through the Deerhaven had to go through an environmental review process as well. And when we've been comparing our stormwater requirements to theirs, it's because the requirements were different. Is that correct? They were different when Deerhaven's was approved, so that it's
apparently
continued to evolve over the time that the property's been owned. So.
And then so basically what they were saying is that it's not really when these Deerhaven houses are constructed, like now, that they have to conform to the rules and regulations that are in place right now. They actually have to conform to rules and regulations of when Deerhaven was incorporated in 1999. And our argument was, okay, well, our lot is actually a continuation of the Tamara Heights development that started in 1971. So by that criteria, we should be able to go back to the 1971 rules. But apparently that logic kind of disappeared after I brought that up. Anyway, it's a little frustrating that, you know, we really couldn't negotiate some of these smaller points, and here we are.
Questions? Thank you. Chris? Could you respond to those issues?
Sure. We don't doubt that many of these grievances are real and troubling to the Dyes at all. And staff have spent hundreds of hours trying to work things through, facilitate the development process with them. The staff you see here are some of those who have worked with them in one aspect or another of their development. And what we try to do, we explain with all the claimants, and certainly the Dyes, we don't have the ability to change the law. We are there to help facilitate and implement the law as best we can. So we've negotiated with them to the extent that we have the flexibility and the power under the law. And some of the things that they are talking about, we've tried to work with them and find workable solutions. And we're willing to continue to try to do that. I think for today's, the point I would make today, though, is that these are grievances that are outside of Measure 37. To us, Measure 37 covers the issues that I talked about. And we are willing to continue to work with them on a staff level to try to work through these grievances to the extent that we have the power. But I think they have to understand, as we try to explain to all the Measure 37 claimants, we can't change the law or break the law for them. We can try to implement it, and we've been doing that for several years with the Dyes.
They raised a point at the very end, I think Mrs. Dye, that the fencing and the 5,000 square feet came in 95.
My understanding,
not 91, is that correct?
No, my understanding is that the environmental regulations have stayed essentially the same since 91 when the council placed the environmental zone on the property. There have been slight changes here and there, mostly in process, actually, to make the process more flexible.
The fencing and the preservation were not added subsequent to
that? They were not added, no. And if you want to get into the details, Eric Engstrom, who has been working on this for years and years, can explain the details of the process. If you want to talk about that, we can go there if you want. And we can give you as much detail as you would like today. I was trying to keep the discussion focused on the Measure 37 claim, which to us is pretty clear, and then try to work through these details with them on the staff level as we're able to. But if you'd like those details, we have the staff here to explain that to you.
Well, my first impression is that you're right, that the issues raised aren't really related to Measure 37, and I think whether intended to or not, I think the claimant acknowledged that he was frustrated with some of the regulations and filed a claim out of that frustration. But specifically, I was curious about the tree issue.
And we can give you a lot of detail on that, too. We have, in fact, Kim Miller and Eric Engstrom have both worked on the tree issue. There are ways for them to cut down the tree immediately if it presents an immediate
threat. That's kind of what I wanted to ask.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because do our staff have the capability of making a judgment whether a tree is safe or not without having one go through an expensive process? I mean, staff, do we have a process whereby we can?
There is a process, but somebody else needs to explain that to you because I don't know exactly what
they
it
come
is.
Up. Also, Chris, about the fence, just explain to me why they can't have a fence there.
Well, the intent of the law, and I'm certainly not an expert on this, but my understanding, the intent of the environmental zone is to try to preserve the resource as well as we can for wildlife and natural area as much as possible. We try, as Mrs. Dye explained, to facilitate the building of natural fences when that's possible. We understand that there are problems with this. We'll try to work that out as best we can, but that's the intent of it, is to try to keep this area natural to protect the resources best we can in a natural way.
Appears as if there's another wildlife that snuck in.
That's I'm sure that's true. We don't doubt that at all.
Could I maybe ask a question to help frame the question you're about to answer? We haven't ruled yet on our view of the Measure 37 claim, so there's still some room to have some discussion. I guess the question I'd like to ask is, well, you're talking about the specifics of the regulations. Well, I think it's the correct argument that you're giving to the applicant that, you know, you can't and should not attempt to change the law when you're reviewing it. The council can modify conditions and has a little more leeway than the staff would, and particularly in a disputed claim like this. So I guess what I'd be looking for is, in your opinion, are there some things in there that perhaps as part of ruling on this claim we could give some leeway on without hurting the intent of the rules? Or is it your opinion that the rules as they're interpreted are having the right result and we ought to stick to that slightly different question than do they have a Measure 37 claim?
Well, with regard to the fence, I'm not qualified to answer that because there's far more to it than I understand. There have been years of research and staff work gone into this, and that's encompassed in the environmental zone protections that you passed. So I can't speak to that right now. Maybe there are with regard to the tree issue. I'm not sure.
Hi, my name is Eric Engstrom. I'm a supervising planner with the Bureau of Development Services. And I was involved with the environmental review process that Mr. Dye went through. I'm going to try and shed some light on the tree question. And before I do that, though, I wanted to mention one thing about the question of which regulations came in when and see if I can help clarify that. When the environmental zone overlay was first created, the only avenue to get approval for development in that overlay was through discretionary environmental review. It was later, subsequently, that the second track was added, which included the development standards, which essentially said, if you can meet these standards, then you don't have to go through that first track. So at the time of ownership of the initial purchase, in this case, the rule was that that any development on the property would have required discretionary environmental review. Mr. Dye subsequently has gone through discretionary environmental review, and that's the basis of the building permit that the Bureau issued. So from a Measure 37 point of view, the same rules were applied, same basic rules were applied today to his permit that would have been applied had he applied for the same permit when the purchase at the original purchase date. Yes, there were certain standards and other procedural simplified processes added to the environmental overlay subsequent to that ownership, but those essentially amount to additional exceptions that get you out of environmental review, and those don't amount to restrictive standards in that sense. So with that sort of broader look, the fence issue is the fence standard is one of those standards that was subsequently added. Prior to the fence standard existing, a fence would have required environmental review. After the fence standard was added, fences that meet the standard don't require environmental review. Other fences may be applied for or may be requested through environmental review still. So that's kind of the nature of that standard and why it's being discussed here.
Excuse me, but when was that added? What year?
It was added, I believe, in 95, and I believe that's what Mr. Dye is referring to. But again, the city's regulations required discretionary environmental review for anything prior to that, and so the addition of that standard basically amounted to a loosening of the rules by saying that we won't review certain fences if they're fairly straightforward.
So that means they're not absolutely prohibited from a fence. They just have to go through discretionary environmental review?
That's right, right. And that remains a viable option. You asked a question about the trees. The current code does include exemptions for trees that are immediate hazards, and the Bureau of Development Services has let Mr. Dye know that if it is an immediate hazard, the tree can come down immediately. We're not going to be the ones standing in the way of or requiring a hazard to remain if that's the case. What our advice was that because this is an environmental overlay and that tree was part of the adopted tree preservation plan, our advice was have an arborist look at it because that having that arborist look at that protects him from anyone else out there alleging that there's a violation from him removing that tree.
But my question was, don't we have the capacity to look at it and conclude that it might be a hazard?
I'm not an arborist, so I'm not going to be the one that does that. But we can do that. We don't generally make those determinations as part of private building permit requests. The city forester generally restricts their activities to looking at street trees and trees in parks. So we, for various reasons, liability and such, we generally try and avoid making determinations about trees on private property.
So it was advice.
It was advice that if the tree's a hazard, it can come down. I just want to be clear about that.
But that has to be determined by an independent arborist.
No, we're just saying that if somebody alleges later that that tree was illegally taken down, it's a good idea to have had an arborist look at it, to have that in writing so that you have a defense, otherwise we can't tell whether it was just a violation of the E-zone later if someone makes that allegation or if it was a hazard. So our standard advice is work with an arborist. There's not a requirement, we're not making it a requirement or a precondition of tree removal to do that if it's a hazard.
I'm just trying to get to the place where both sides agree it's a hazard. If you don't hire an arborist, how do you agree that it hasn't been taken down improperly? Because he says it was a hazard?
Right. If it comes down tomorrow and we get a through a third party, someone complains that a tree has been taken down without proper permits, then we have to figure out what happened. And to the extent that an arborist was involved that he had an arborist look at it, that helps us find in his favor that there's no violation.
That kind of gets me back to my original question, which was if there may be a process whereby we have to determine if it was taken down properly or not, why wouldn't we have somebody go out before it's taken down and go, okay, that looks like it could be a hazard, and say we've...
And we've essentially done that. The city forester has taken a look at it from a windshield survey, having gone by the site, and said, yeah, it could be a concern, and we recommend it. That's where the recommendation for a root exploration came from, was from the city forester.
Let's say, based on that, just that informal kind of observation, they took it down, and somebody complained. Would they be able to say, yeah, but the forester looked and said it could have been a problem, and therefore, I'm giving the benefit of the doubt to the...
We could do that, but as with all land use, there's a procedural process of appeal, and we're not the final decision maker on that often. So
what happens if someone complained about that? What's the worst thing that can happen to these folks?
An environmental violation for not complying with a condition of approval from the land use decision.
But in retrospect, how would you know? The tree's gone.
We would be responding to a complaint from a third party that the tree came down without...
Is there a burden of proof to show that it wasn't dangerous?
In this case, the tree is part of an approved tree preservation plan adopted through a land use procedure. So there's been a process of neighborhood notification and public decision-making about which trees to preserve on a site. And our job at this point at BDS would be to implement that tree preservation plan. So we would be asking for, when there's active development going on a property and a tree comes down, generally our request would be to the developer or the contractor is, what happened to that tree? If we were to say, to put the burden of proof on the neighborhood to prove that it wasn't a hazard, the neighborhood would have the right to appeal that determination, and we don't have a control over where that goes. So generally, we try and make a best case guess as to what we think is going on there when we make that decision. But again, I want to stress that these are issues we're happy to continue working on with this applicant. But this is not a Measure 37 discussion because the regulation predates the ownership.
I said that, and I think it almost sounds to me like all parties have stipulated to that. The hard part is with like decisions on trees, and I certainly understand your conservative approach, not wanting to take a position that could end up coming back to haunt us. On the other hand, sometimes something like that is actually not as complicated as it appears, and you know, you can look at it and not be an arborist and go, yeah, okay, I can see in a wet climate and a good wind that might come down and go this way. I'm just wondering why we can't just say an instant, I'm not necessarily just even talking about that tree, but in instances like that, have just some process where we go, okay, that could be a problem, so we're not going to take a chance. If you want to take it down, take it down.
It could be a problem. It's not so clear cut to me that it's a problem that we've gone there yet.
If we're the city and we are the ones that are going to enforce against the rule being violated, why can't we in advance say we've made a judgment that this wouldn't violate the rule?
We can do that if we think we have enough evidence to safely stand behind that. we also have a responsibility to ensure that trees aren't coming down that are for no reason, and there's a public interest that we're trying to carry forward in preserving tree canopy in that neighborhood because of the Johnson Creek flooding issue. So,
which is why I'm saying you in advance take a look at it, and
right.
just kind of instinctively, it's
and which is what we've done by having the city forester drive by and take a look, and at this point where we were at was it could potentially be, but we don't know yet.
You wouldn't know until it fell. I mean.
Well, I guess
have an arborist come and do a more detailed look.
Right. I mean, that's what we've recommended is that somebody look at it and more careful.
Rendered an opinion, this is a hazard, or it's dead, or whatever. Then it could be felled with no consequence of or no potential of somebody making a third party complaint that would
right.
be substantiated. I'm assuming.
I think the reason we didn't go in that direction is we didn't get a clear statement from our city forester that it was an immediate hazard. And there have been situations where the city forester has said to us, this is a hazard, and when we get that clear message, we can act on that. We didn't get that clear of a message in this case.
Windshield obstructed his view. If he got out of the car, maybe he would have had a different opinion.
I want to get back to my question because, I mean, I think it's, for whatever reason, you know, and I'm not saying you guys did anything wrong. Both sides have sort of, for one reason or another, made a decision that this is worth putting in front of us. And staff has had a hand in that, as had the other folks. We had an agreement that you guys worked out. I think it's well known the council likes to work through these things on Measure 37, and that we've been trying to set a precedent that, when at all possible, we'd like to mediate Measure 37 claims because we're trying to send, and also that we will litigate anything that's not right because we've been trying to send a message to property owners that we get the law, we're going to enforce it, it was passed, and we're going to try and make it right, but we're also not going to stand up for frivolous claims. I mean, just to maybe rephrase my question, this seems like one that should be worked out at the staff level. I would be happy to ask the forester, you know, if the Parks Commissioner agrees, to go out and study it on our dime and come to a conclusion or something so that, I mean, I've got a couple here who's working pretty hard, I think, to try and get this thing right. I'm not saying they haven't dug in and been stubborn at some things or not. I'm not trying to say that, but apparently, you know, saying, gosh, I don't want to pay the $700. We got, you know, the forester who said, hey, it probably is bad. You guys are saying, well, you haven't proved it. I mean, just to be blunt, I think this one needs a little work here, Chris, to
okay.
come to a conclusion. And we can toss it if you want, but I just think it's not the style of what we're trying to do here.
No, absolutely. That's always our first intent also. And we're right now working with several dozen claimants who have put their claims on hold to allow us time to do that. But at a certain point, if the claimant decides not to put their claim on hold, we're obligated under the 180-day rule to bring it to you to avoid further liability to the city, and that's why we brought this to you today. And in some ways, I'm sorry that we had to, because I think you're right. This should be worked out on the staff level, and I believe we've done everything we can and will continue to do that to try to work it out, and we'll do that.
I'd like to ask two questions. The first dealt with the issue that the rest of the development had a different standard in terms of stormwater runoff than this property.
The Deerhaven development?
Yes.
There's a representative from BES who can speak to that. I'm not qualified to.
I'm Lana Danaher with Bureau of Environmental Services. Deerhaven actually came under the 2000, I believe it was the 2002 Stormwater Management Manual. We have a 2004 version. The difference is pretty slight, except for the stormwater disposal hierarchy that was a result of negotiations with EPA and DEQ that gives preference to on-site infiltration through vegetated facilities, such as stormwater planters. Other than that, it's pretty much the same. It's applicable here because of the long driveway. I believe he said 1,000 square feet. I frankly did not recall what the square footage was. And, of course, our city policy is that stormwater is managed on-site. It can be disposed of off-site once it's been treated and detained if they cannot dispose of it on-site. And so you do see some of the sites in Deerhaven, for example, who have used a variety of things from planters, soakage trenches. I think there was a storm scepter. And then overflowed to the street. So there were some of that. I'm not sure which lots he looked at and which ones he didn't, but there was quite a mixture in Deerhaven. I believe that there's a pond that was built for the streets that includes the street in front of his house. And it was built for street flow and incidental overflow. It was not sized for additional flow from individual lots. Having said all that, we do have what's called a special circumstances process. If it's not possible, not feasible, for him to get planters in for that driveway, he can ask to do an off-site management fee, and we can look to see whether the additional flow could be handled. He has not applied for special circumstances. I don't know that it would be approved, but it's possible.
In terms of the fence, just my last question, I'd like to find out. You said that in most instances an owner could build a fence, but that if there was some variance, then they had to go through some process.
Yes, a fence is allowed. The current rules, a fence is allowed within the approved disturbance area only. And I believe the issue here is that the fence that Mr. Dye would like to put in extends into the portion of the property that was designated to remain in a natural state. The fence, you can request a fence through environmental review, and my understanding is Mr. Dye is presumably objecting to the procedural and time expense of going through that process. That's the same process that was in place when he purchased the property for a fence. What I heard today about some of the fire issues, I'd be willing to talk with him about some other ideas I have about how we might deal with a fence. If it's an immediate fire hazard and we can get someone to assess that, there's a possibility we could put up a temporary fence to try and interrupt the situation without going through environmental review. That's something we're willing to talk about. That's one option.
What is the? Can you give me a cost of an environmental review?
I believe the council lowered that cost last year, subsequent to Measure 37 going into effect, to try and entice more folks to go through that process. But I think it's around the order of $1,000 for that review right now.
So, I mean, getting to sort of what Commissioner Sten's been talking about in the interest of maybe getting to I don't agree this is a legitimate Measure 37 claim, but nevertheless, there's some real concerns here that we might have discretion to address, such as waiving the environmental review fee.
But I have, and I'm, nobody likes to find compromises on these more than I do. I mean, I appreciate that, but this is a standard review that was in place when the property was purchased, and this is not an unknown regulation. It's a fairly standard, I think, approach. Having some experience myself with environmental zones, shouldn't be a surprise to anybody you can't fence off one of those areas.
Yeah. I'm just thinking more about the sort of the change in the use over time of the back of that property, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean,
I need to hear a little bit more about that, too. I'm very familiar with this area, and that's not a phenomenon I am at all familiar with. I mean, I walk through this area quite a bit, and I'm happy to be proved wrong, but there may have been something here and there, but this is not an area that's known to have roving gangs of kids in the woods doing bonfires by any means. But I'm open, if somebody has some evidence that I'm completely wrong, I'm willing to listen to that, but that's definitely not just the first I've ever heard of anything like that.
Well, I agree with Commissioner Sten in the sense that I think that the staff could work more with the owners to figure out if there are some other solutions. But I, like a couple of the other folks, do not feel that this rises to the level of a Measure 37 claim. So some other mechanism has to be in place to bring about some reasonable effort to work with, and I think it's incumbent upon the claimant in this case, too. Any further questions?
Well, I just want to be real clear, because this is the staff that I'm assigned to work with a lot, so I don't want them to get the wrong message from this. I mean, I agree, and I've worked with the BDS staff a lot to think in terms of solutions where they have issues that they can make an independent judgment about. They have the authority to do that. On the other hand, I don't want to send a message that Measure 37 might be a tool some can use that are mad about regulations in order to get some relief where other processes don't work. And we have to find a balance. And I am concerned about the tree approach. I think I was actually thinking we need to talk more about how we can internally maybe have a more expedited process that doesn't involve hiring consultants. On the other hand, I really am concerned about sending a message that we would use Measure 37 as a tool to have the council relax rules that really are should be fairly well understood and have been in place for some time. So I know there's a balance there and there's some judgment there. I just don't want the staff to think that we're saying if somebody files a Measure 37 claim and they want to build a fence and they weren't allowed to, somehow they're going to circumvent that regulation to build a fence. That's not fair to the community or the neighbors or, I would argue, the claimants ultimately. And there's a balance here. I'm sensing, like the rest of the council, that we could do a little better job in some particular areas in helping achieve that balance. But on the overall claim, I'm not persuaded that we should be doing a lot of what's being asked of us. And the staff's working very hard on this. I know they are. I appreciate what they've done. It's a hard balance to find. But I don't want to walk out of here with the message that if you're not happy with a regulation, you can file a Measure 37 claim and we're going to waive it.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I am saying that the as somebody who's voted for almost all these regulations and fully owns and supports them, that they are not cleverly crafted to fit every lot, nor can they be. And so what I was trying to ask is that in this situation in which I think a good work, there seems to be good faith on both sides and the gap on evidence is relatively small, is it appropriate for the council to exercise a little bit of judgment and create some goodwill? And I wouldn't do that, which is why I asked the question, which I heard you weren't prepared to answer, and I'm totally fine with that, of in your opinion, as opposed to, you know, exactly the way this thing works on the environmental zone, do you see any room to work on this? I mean, it's just if both sides have been working on this for years and somebody actually has an opinion that maybe the exact reading of the fence law in this environmental zone doesn't exactly do what it's supposed to do on this lot, I would be open to using the power of the council, which doesn't happen very often, to craft a compromise. And it would not scare me that I was sending the wrong message, because I would only do it if you guys felt there was a way to solve it that was not available to you. And I have not seen a preponderance of sort of good faith claims in front of us. So I don't fear this happening a lot. So I guess that's where I'm coming from, because I don't want in any way be interpreted to be sending a message to the team that's any different than yours. You guys shouldn't. I was really more trying to say, if you had a little more leeway, which you don't have, is there some way you could solve this problem that has not been available to you yet that perhaps would be available to us as part of settling a claim?
To answer the question,
could we put the fence somewhere that would work and get this done with?
To answer the general question you had about how much leeway I think we have. I think the leeway we have here I think the sticking point we have here that is the procedural issues. There are ways and arguments that can be made to get to a place where there's a fence on this property and where this tree is recognized as being a hazard and it's allowed to be removed. Those are with certain sets of facts and discoveries, we can get to that point. The issue, I think, here is that those involve process that are in place. And those processes, for better or worse, take time and are expensive.
Well, I don't want to sound like I'm flip-flopping here, but again, I think we have the ability to exercise some judgment at times as to whether or not to employ all those processes. It involves us sometimes taking a position that is sometimes uncomfortable because we're actually maybe taking a position we have to defend. In the instance of the tree, we looked at it, we made a judgment that it could be a problem if neighbors have complained and they're concerned and it's leaning, okay. Mitigate it by planting something else somewhere on the property and you can take it down. Those kinds of things, I think we